And we're also going to be advising on the IDMS, which stands for the Infrastructure Delivery Management System, which also interfaces with the standard. And we also then overall want to suggest that what holds all of this together is the Government Immovable Management Act of 2007, so that the standard can actually be understood properly within its proper context and in terms of what it expects for all the infrastructure players in the public sector should do, and what that means for the processes of budget management and allocation. Thanks, Chairperson. If you will allow, I want to ask Mr. Richard Rapiri to start to deal with the first question, to deal with the overview of the standard itself.
Thank you, Honourable Member. And thanks again for the opportunity to present in this meeting. I will explain in terms of the background of the standard, which is the Standard for Infrastructure Procurement and Delivery Management, which was issued in terms of Section 76, Subsection 4C of the Public Finance Management Act, which was applicable on the 1st of July 2016. The first component of the standard basically was applicable to, firstly, targeting the national departments and provincial departments, and therefore will be adopted by the municipal or the local environment at a later year. So that has to be taken through to their municipal processes to do that. And that model policy of the infrastructure procurement standard is linked basically to the SIPDM, which is also in terms of Section 168 of the Municipal Finance Management Act, in support of the MFMA and also Regulation 3.2 of the National Treasury Guideline determining the standards for municipal supply chain management. Basically, if one looks at the SIPDM as it commonly known, it's basically a combination of the what we have as the Infrastructure Delivery Management System, which was a tool for infrastructure delivery that was actually championed by CIDB together with partners like National Treasury, the DPW, and other infrastructure units like your education and also DBSA, where there was this formation where we looked at how best we can introduce a best practice model in terms of how we can actually deliver infrastructure with minimum risks and also to the best value. And therefore, if you look at the standards, it actually includes some of the elements of the IDMS and also what the CIDB has already introduced in the CIDB processes or CIDB regulations or mandate through the Standard for Uniformity, which was a prescriptive document that guides public sector within which how they should actually procure infrastructure. And also some of the supply chain management regulations. What the Standard seeks to approve or seeks to achieve is to promote competency of staff dealing with infrastructure and support and specialization of services. So basically here, it challenges institutions of government to say that, do we have the necessary capacity or capability within our resources to actually deliver infrastructure that we need? And also, it promotes that competency by also improving the accountability in terms of the actions and the decisions that are taken in the value chain of delivering that infrastructure. So that's basically what the standard in the background would say. It further defines within the standard the control frameworks, where this framework looks at your planning processes, your design components, and your execution of your infrastructure projects, and also tracking of such projects and monitoring performance of those projects. These control frameworks are basically embedded within the IDMS, and we will go further later on in terms of what those control frameworks mean to us in terms of your procurement gates, your framework gates, and other gateway systems that have been introduced through the IDMS processes. The requirements for the following as applied in the infrastructure has been adopted basically within the IDMS environment, which looks at your institutional arrangements, your demand management processes, your acquisition management processes, your contract management and strategies, your logistic management, and also disposal management, and how do we then report that information within the SCM environment, and how do we actually regularly assess the performance of the SCM within the infrastructure space, and where can we define risks and internal controls where we can manage those processes. The standard seeks to regulate the decision-making process associated with the procurement, planning, design, execution of infrastructure projects through control frameworks and policies associated with assigning responsibilities for approving or accepting deliverables associated with the gate controls or with the deliverables themselves, and also looking at how those are authorized within the procurement processes and what procedures are adopted doing so. So now if one looks at the standards for uniformity, there are about 18 procedures that have been already embedded within the standard for uniformity in construction procurement that the CIDB has introduced since 2004. And those are the likes of your procurement procedures, such as your two-stage processes, procurement processes, your shopping procedures. Those are normal procedures, but there are some procedures that have been identified that are related to infrastructure that are guided in the standard for uniformity. So that is why if you look at the standard, it actually incorporates what was already embedded in the SFU, and then it makes it a prescriptive process. The aspects of delivery management and the processes and methods and procedures and how procurement documents are basically packaged. What we have realized at the CIDB over the years, when we actually introduced the standard for uniformity, we realized that different land departments were actually packaging their procurement documents differently. And therefore, the CIDB took upon themselves to now establish a one uniform standard of how procurement documents can be produced so that they can be an easier auditable process in that area, so that we can see where are the areas where they have gone or they have undergone wrong. The organs of state who are responsible for infrastructure shall establish a suitable infrastructure procurement and delivery supply chain management policy to implement the standard. Basically, what the standard compels now institutions of government and says, now we need to change our modus operandi in how do we deliver infrastructure. It means that, yes, you might have a supply chain policy, but your supply chain policy is mostly geared at procuring pans, procuring tables, and all those. So we are now outlining to say that infrastructure procurement and the normal goods and services are totally different processes. So we need to adopt a different process in that area. So this standard is basically seeks to achieve that alignment that infrastructure should be looked at its own component and its own merit. Such policy shall have minimum requirements such as assigning responsibility for approving or accepting deliverables associated with the gate in the control frameworks or authorizing of tender processes, meaning that it's easy for us to go back and trace who have assigned what, who have approved what in that area of that procurement. Therefore, the establishment of committees which are required by law or equivalent quality management and government arrangement. By so saying, we are saying that there are capacity issues in terms of how our infrastructure departments or our departments are structured. The way the departments are structured, they are geared towards the normal goods and services rather than infrastructure. So if you look at the governance structure in terms of the committees that are outlined, there is no capacity or lack of capacity within those committees for them to actually analyze how infrastructure is procured. So this poses a challenge for us to say that there is a serious lack of either skill within the SEM environment, or maybe it is a challenge to say that we need to change and actually adopt a new model with this regard. It also establishes delegations for awarding of contracts or issuing of any order in terms of framework contracts and how those framework contracts will be established. And also, it establishes ethical standards for those involved in construction procurement, which has already been the CIDB prescriptive document through our CIDB code of conduct. So that has already now put the responsibility in each and every person who is in the infrastructure procurement space to know that if you are dealing with infrastructure, you have to comply with the CIDB or any other legislation that is out there. There is in the standard where it actually promotes what we call an agency agreement, which will be entered between organs of state where responsibilities for implementations are assigned or delegated, and such agreements. And basically here we're talking that the agreements that implementing agents, the principal agent, if one department as public works or any other agent could be a consultant, if the consultant makes decisions on behalf of that municipality or on behalf of that client, the principal agent or that client, he has that fiduciary duty to make sure that whatever is implemented within the South African law and order. Therefore, it also includes the delivery management agreement, which has relevant set out at least the following overall aims and objectives and priorities of that agreement, governance structures, reporting requirements, the scope of services to be performed by the implementer during each year of the financial year, the projects and packages which are included in the infrastructure plan which are to be delivered, and the time frames for doing so, the roles and responsibilities of parties to agreements, including requirements for engagement and management of stakeholders, delegations to implementers to accept or the end stage deliverables on an agency basis, and also contributing resources, including human resources and dispute resolution that may arise within those processes. So basically it sets that responsibility, and also it doesn't shy away or it doesn't give or it doesn't leave out any gap in terms of the fiduciary duties of the principal agents to actually oversee some of those aspects. The implemented supply chain management system shall be used to procure goods and services or any combination thereof for infrastructure covered in the agency agreement. So what is new in this industry or in this standard is that the definition of construction works was actually extended as opposed to the definition that was in the standard for uniformity. Now the standard for uniformity, the definition was that it has to be a combination of goods or services that are in conglomeration of industries or sectors that will deliver infrastructure that will result in a fixed asset. Now, the definition which is in the standard has been extended by including that if you are, like for instance, if you are delivering a school, that school, you can procure the school and also the services that are going with that school, in terms of that definition that is in the standard, meaning that you can have one procurement process where the contractor or a person who has been awarded that project can also deliver the furniture that goes with that. It's got more of your value in terms of now you don't have to go out on different procurement processes, and it can deliver value towards that. So you can actually force the measure within the design component and the contracting component to be one in that fashion.
Chairperson, I'm going to abuse now the power you gave to us of saying this is to be an interactive session. It's a lot of information. Maybe I want to ask if there are any questions for this first batch, because I think next because we're not trainers and I'm learning, I'm forcing myself to try to think in the mode of a trainer. I want to refer the committee members to what was said in slide number 8. Just go back to slide 8. Right. This is the crux of what the standard is actually introducing. And if you read what's in red, it says the state, whoever is procuring it, shall establish a suitable infrastructure procurement and delivery supply chain management policy to implement this standard. I want to just maybe members to please to focus on that. Never before was there ever such a requirement. It's a new requirement. There are questions we are proposing in slide 35 ahead when we get there, but this is the essence of it all. The standard is asking that you have to start with infrastructure to have a different policy. And it can say, if you're translating it to a question, when you're asking the minister, have you established policy, which is a prerogative of an executive authority, that allows you to implement the standard as a way of guiding? And then, Chair, yes, ma'am.
Right, I just want to check. Maybe just allow him to finish and then I will then
But no, it's fine, ma'am. Actually, I think for me, this is the key point I wanted to make around here. Because this is what the standard is effectively changing the environment. It's changing the rules of engagement about. So for me, even if we were to, in fact, even what we attempt to do next in terms of your question, which says, how do we then exercise oversight? It all stems from this. Everything flows from this. Everything we say after, so I'm prepared to stop here because everything flows from that.
Let me then allow members to turn to slide, slide 8. I think we'll just make aware of the importance of slide 8 and how we can then follow up in terms of our oversight, asking the minister very well, especially those coming in the building, responsible for this, because they have. Any other, Mr. Gunchi? The Honourable Member
Sipanyane? Honourable Member Banana? Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. Just a brief clarification. I think these are very important standards and all that. But perhaps I'm preempting something that's still going to be presented because, like you say, how do we exercise oversight? But the one thing I would be interested in is how are you then able to, from your side, exercise oversight? How do you monitor, actually, from your side, that are implemented? So I just want to ask that perhaps you are still going to talk about it. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable Member Banana.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, mine is also a point of clarity. I wanted to find out that each and every, when we talk about organs of state, who are responsible for infrastructure? I know there are different departments. Do you want to tell us that each and every department must have this? If that is the case, I don't know whether we are, are we sure what we're talking about? Because I know some departments who do not have capacity. In the inner departments, that is why they are asking other departments to do that. So are you saying each and every department must have these standards? If they don't have that capacity, then what is going to happen?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just trying to get my head around what you're saying. Basically, Public Works is responsible for infrastructure. If I'm on the same page as you are, this suggests organs of state, so now there are going to be other organs of state apart from public works who are responsible for their own infrastructure establishments. Does that still fall under public works, or is this independent of public works? So that's the first issue. Do you still then have an oversight control over other departments where infrastructure is established? And then it worries me that it says here, shall establish a suitable infrastructure procurement. What's been the case up to now? Because this saying is going to be happening in the future. So up to now and currently, the contracts that are currently in force, what's ruling those? What's in place to try and see that things happen correctly at the moment? Because you also say, or I don't know, gentlemen, there's a serious lack of skills in this particular area. I mean, this is like scary news, because it says what's going on now, there's not a lot of skill around, and people are guessing and grabbing at straws and all sorts of things. I'm not suggesting they are necessarily, but the possibility is there. And just clarify those issues for me, please. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thanks, Chair.
I will not try to preempt what's still coming. I will cover some of the issues that may make what's coming much more clearer. So please bear with us, and if I don't address some of the issues, please re-raise them again. I want to start from the back, some of the last questions, and move to the first questions first. I want to combine the question that my chairperson jumped on of does it mean all, and then linked to the last question that is saying dealing with issues of all departments do it or not. But I think let me provide my understanding. I'm not saying this is gospel, because firstly, this environment, we are jointly managing it with National Treasure. It's an area of that is there's the responsibility of National Treasure and the responsibility of CIDP. But the CIDP responsibility is confined within construction. Outside of that, it is National Treasure. Then, yes. Okay. It's in terms of the procurement legislation is the mandate of National Treasury. So National Treasury controls all of that. It sets the policy and whatever is required around it. Our Act says within the existing framework, we are then responsible for construction issues, which then brings into force the Intergovernmental Relations Act, and to that effect, we have developed, for at least for now, instrument, an MOA, to allow us to manage that space together. And this came as a result of the introduction of procurement reforms that introduced the standard. So, in short, trying to draw the boundary, everything that falls within the construction realm, CIDP has a say. Everything that's outside construction, we do not have a say, in as far as procurement is concerned in the country. Then, where for whom this question is asking should have this policy? This is why I think in the preface I made the point, which we will deal with later on, of saying you can't treat the standard in isolation. If there's a standard for uniformity, there's IDMS, and the glue that holds everything together is KIAMA. Infrastructure. Okay, IDMS. Sorry, no. I will try. IDMS, Infrastructure Delivery Management System. All right. And then IDMS, Infrastructure Delivery Management System. Okay. Right. And then there's GIAMA, Government Immovable Management Act. I want to suggest that the Government Immovable Management Act actually is the glue that holds all three together. The standard, SFU, and IDMS. Because within GIAMA, there is then a differentiation of organs of state to answer the question that there was that quick response. In that, there are certain departments that have the agency role, the role of an implementing agent on behalf of the state. To the extent that GIAMA makes a distinction in terms of saying what should an implementing agent or a client do? In terms of that distinction, if a department, an organ of state, is deemed to be a custodian, because that's the language used in the Act, if a department is deemed to be a custodian, remembering that South Africa is a mixture of a federal and a central state, a centralized state, in that National Department of Public Works, without talking on their behalf, they have what is called in the Constitution national competencies. So for everything that's a national competence, National Department of Public Works is the custodian. Then all departments that are that fall within that, that are covered as national competencies, then are the clients of the custodian, and the Act defines them as users. To that end, my interpretation would be the custodian is the one that is expected to have this particular policy, because it is the one that must hold the capacity and the competencies to deliver on behalf of the other client devices. And then obviously there are provincial competencies and others. So within the various spheres of government, my considered view is that if you read it together with Kiyama, you need to identify who is the custodian departments, and that custodian must have this policy. And they are then required to produce what is called asset management plans, which then says, if since you are, let's assume you are talking to police, police must have a view of how they're going to use their budget in totality to make sure, over and above making sure the police are fully equipped to be able to discharge their jobs, but they've got operational base in terms of infrastructure from which they can carry out their work. Now, they are required to produce a user perspective of what do they think as a user are their user requirements over a defined period of time. Then DPW in the national competency context is required to produce a custodian asset management plan, which says, I hear all of you as user departments, but I have a bird's eye view. I need to rationalize everybody's needs and wants to something that is affordable and something that makes sense in terms of an infrastructure plan. So they have a responsibility of then saying, as a custodian, I've got a particular view of what the asset, how the asset management for these clients should look like. And all of this then gets submitted in the budgeting process to National Treasury to allocate funds in accordance with that. What I cannot offer a perspective on is how far are the user departments and custodian departments in complying with Kiyama in so far producing those plans, so that National Treasury can do effective and efficient budget allocation in terms of what's available in the fiscus. So that, I think, at a particular level answers the questions that were asked in that regard to a certain degree, but not in totality. The issues around capacity and competency are going to be covered by Ms. George, I think, when you are dealing with your with the areas of contracting strategies. Because the question of whether or not you have the requisite skills is a function of what contracting strategies or what procurement strategy you adopt, which is what is called here. That will become clear in that presentation, in that the fact that you may not have a design office or engineers does not mean you cannot undertake infrastructure procurement, but there's a particular form of procure or contracting strategy you need to adopt in your policy that acknowledges your current competencies and capacities for you to be able to implement. The challenge arises when this is not done, what is asked for, that is to determine your procurement policies and standards. Because when you don't do that, then as an implementing agent, an infrastructure implementing organ of state, you fall on default positions, which may not be consistent with your capacities in terms of what you can do and what you can't do or what is prescribed. Now, what the standard then does in terms of the SIPDM, it then makes it compulsory, as it became compulsory for you to comply with it as of July 2016. This is where it really, really becomes critical to say, have you done what you are asked for to do? But the intricacies of it will be dealt with in the following slides. But please keep the questions also, because we're also trying to be trainers in the process. The question of saying, how do we monitor? Honest answer, we have not even begun to look into this particular area to ask the question, to monitor the question, are you doing this or not? And partly for that reason, we are of the view that this is Treasury put out the standard. It was not us, and we would understand that Treasury is the one that should then actually monitor this particular aspect of compliance. How many departments are actually in compliance? Obviously, Treasury doesn't do audits. That's a function of the Auditor General for public sector entities. But that is a process. I need to hasten to say, however, there is an issue that does need to be taken up around the manner in which the standard was introduced. I'm not trying to exhaust the presentation. Some of these issues will be tabled, but just to flag them. One, there was no transitional period. And I think that becomes an Achilles heel of the standard. There was no transitional period. Two, our view as CIDB, which we have not discussed with anybody else, is that what does CIAS stands for? You know these acronyms of government. CIAS. Yeah, I'll explain the process. There's an acronym called CIAS, which says when you introduce any legislative requirement that's new, you can't just introduce it without doing an economic, social, and other impact assessment before you introduce it. It does not appear to us that there was an impact assessment of this in terms of how can it actually be done. And linked to that, simple language, was it costed? To us, it is not obvious that this standard was costed in terms of what it means in terms of its implementation. I think I'm dealing with just the thing, which is why I'm saying everything in the presentation that follows, obviously tempered also by some of your questions around transformation, is focused on that particular bullet in slide.
Honourable members, do you
have follow-up questions?
This is not just what you costed. It's a serious problem. Because it seems as if there's no budget for it. And how can they implement it?
Okay, what I like with all of us sitting here, we are leaders in our own right. Now, what is expected of leaders is to find solutions. So, what is a possible solution? So that we don't just discuss and not provide solutions as well. Possible solutions. Okay. So, on that. All right. Just write it down. I just want to check if there's another, it's a relevant question. Thank you very much, Honourable Member. Any other follow-up question?
May I ask other questions relating to this, the section we've heard so far? Just if I look at slide 9, we speak of an agency agreement between organ of state and the implementing agent, and then a service delivery agreement below that. So we're going to have a whole range of agreements between the various parties contracting here. Now, this committee's had the experience, we've been out on site, and we've been, say, to the Eastern Cape, where we've had a look at schools being built, approaching a finalization stage in some instances, and it became very clear to us that there's a huge problem with the implementing agents, because they're just missing. They're nowhere to be seen. The contractors on site, and there's every now and so often somebody from the Department of Public Works comes and has a look, sees that everything's on track, he talks to the clerk of works, he hears what's going on. The implementing agent is nowhere to be seen. He's in an office in Pretoria somewhere, and there's just no real connect between what's going on. And it poses a huge problem because you see all these things happening that nobody seems to be quite sure of what's going on. Where there's a huge problem on the ground, one instance we had where the whole job had been held up for some time because the community was unhappy because no members of the community had been approached to be employed on the project initially, and this everything ground to a halt. But the implementing agent was nowhere to be seen in any of this picture. He just left it to the contractor to have meetings and consultations and try to sort out the problem. From your point of view, isn't this part of developing this industry, and shouldn't this be addressed in here somewhere as well? If I could just get some kind of feeling on your view on that kind of thing. Thank you.
If I may ask, do you have a role in determining whether the project is appropriately priced. In other words, not overpriced, not underpriced. And that would include checking, for instance, whether the construction company involved, when it, maybe let me put it this way, is there a standard percentage for what you call this thing, when you add your price as a markup? So that you know there is no foul play in all of that. First of all, is that part of your role? And if it is, do you have those kind of stuff?
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Maybe a related question. Perhaps some of the things, perhaps what I'm going to ask would be maybe a role of the of treasurer, like you said, you know, the some. But sometimes you come across situations where there's a lot of the blame game between public works and the department. Just to check, what role would you play there? Because you find that when you are with public works will say it is the department. And when you are with the department, they will say it is the fault of the public works. And the other thing is, if you perhaps go to some of the, you know these projects, some we are told they are national projects, these are provincial projects, then the municipalities and all that. Well, the beneficiaries don't know the difference, but you'll find that a project, an infrastructure project, gets stuck. It doesn't move, and the province will tell you that it is the national government that is responsible for that. Where would you actually find yourself having to get involved, or do you get involved in issues like that? That's why I'm saying that some of these things, you'll find that some of the roles are those of treasurer, but if you can just explain that, what your role would be then in those situations.
Perhaps the other question, Chair, which skipped my mind is, do the IDZs form part of the implementing agents? I know Public Works have IDZs, which itself has been having its own problems. But there was a time when I had Richards Bay, Richards Bay IDZ, and either East London or Port Elizabeth IDZ. Kuka, yes, Kuka. Are they all part of that? And just explain, I mean, an IDZ is a, the name itself speaks for itself. How does it come into infrastructure? We completely ignorant on one level.
Firstly, let me thank you, sir, for bringing in the issue of an interactive session, because you can see, means we're sitting here with these issues, but now you've unleashed, the thinking along the lines of interacting with your presentation. And I'm sure you are patient with us, two of you here. You are patient. Thank you very much. They say patience is virtue. So, thank you. All right, on slide 8, I just want to know, when was this, on bullet 1, was this introduced, the standard introduced? When was it introduced? And after it has been introduced, were departments made aware of this and the importance of compliance? All right. And then you then say on, see, bullet number two, and then the second paragraph under bullet number two, establish committees which are required by law. If you can give us a breakdown of those committees, because it cannot just be committees. What committees are we talking of here? But also, say in your presentation, you then say, which you scared us, say, the committees that are there do not have capacity. What's our recourse? Because if they don't have capacity, obviously there's a high risk. There will be no implementation. Or even if we say we want a accelerated implementation, we will not get it. All right. And then where you talk about Department of Public Works is responsible for asset management. Is there capacity here? Because from where we are sitting, every department that we call, and you know, you make a follow-up on their infrastructure development plans, they would blame Public Works. To an extent that you would remember in one meeting we said, no, let's stop calling all this one, let's call the Department of Public Works. Everybody is public works. But does public works have a capacity? Because then, as a user department, they're not helping government if they don't have capacity. All right? I know you said that don't have a monitoring and evaluation unit. How come? Because I am of the view that every department, for instance yourself, because you set standards, you must then be able to follow up and monitor the actual implementation of those standards. You can't just set standards. It's like me giving birth to a baby and then I leave this baby. And I hope this baby will grow up on its own to become this responsible citizen. Doesn't happen. So how come you don't have a monitoring and evaluation unit? Alright? Do you have, because remember, you're just educating us now, but by now, in my mind, you should be having a list, a whole list of custodian departments of infrastructure development. You should have. Because then if you monitor, you then know that these are the departments. And then you develop a plan for each department. Because the infrastructure, the projects will be different, will differ from one department to the next. Do you have that list? Okay, but thank you so much for indeed emphasizing the need for, actually this one goes to policy. Every policy, or even piece of legislation, there must be an economic assessment, social assessment, and impact assessment, which then says, I don't know who would have influence at what level to say, when government takes decisions, this decision is relevant, but before it is implemented, do we have this? So that we don't come up with policies that are not implementable. Why? Because there are no resources. Instead, those policies are phased. We adopt a phased-in approach. When there is money, maybe we can even say, okay, we're introducing this here, but the implementation stage will be the next financial year. Because somebody needs to awaken government on that one, maybe in your interaction with the National Treasury, but also we must raise it with National Treasury. Because, I mean, you can't come up with legislation that is not implementable because there is no money. Once it's adopted, it must be implemented. All right? And then I don't know where in your standards, I think it's a standard practice, that before any project, because I've seen it in many instances where there is no feasibility study, before any project is undertaken, there must be a feasibility study. That we'll talk to on your slide number 9. You talk about principles and requirements, what will be required, you know, for this to take off the ground, all right, and what will be the recovery costs, retention costs, you know, I mean, that gets discussed at that level. Unless you have a feasibility study, you will not be able to start a project and give it a accurate financial quantification. So to me, it's a requirement. It is a requirement. Now, which means then it will give you, when you say to them, and also you, I think, you, I don't know whether it's you or Public Works must demand on the project sense, so that you then take that into consideration. I think what to me sounds progressive is where you talk about design and engineers in a custodian department or user department, because experience has it that I still don't understand it. That a design will take almost 1 year. What happens then to the budget in that financial year? You end up with an under expenditure, waiting just for a design. Why? Is it because we don't have engineers? Or we're playing games amongst ourselves, I want to keep this one and keep this one. But I think, yes, Baba. Design 1 year is too much. Now, if you look at the desperation of this service, our people waiting for this, and then we give people who we say are technocrats. Yeah? They have the skill, I mean engineers, and then they take 6 months as if there is no hurry. There is. You know, there's desperation, which means also we should think along the same lines. There must be alignment of thinking, and then, sorry to say, but today's officials, they think they have the luxury of time. It can't work. You go by the desperation on the ground. The Constitution says we've got to respond to the needs of the people. It says we must be responsive to the needs. And it, again, in the Constitution, I think it's chapter 10, it will then, under administration, will then say, whatever, it must be timeous. Yes. And if we all agree, the Constitution is the supreme law of this country, why can't we respond to that? And we think we've got the luxury of time. We think, no, we've been here. These things take long. No, it doesn't go by that. It goes by what is the need, and then how the magnitude of the need, and how do we respond to that need? Sensitivity to the needs of the people on the ground. So I don't know, sorry. I thought, okay. And we will then give you an opportunity to respond.
Include in your response the time frames, as Chairperson was saying, the feasibility study. How long should it take? Instances where this thing has delayed a project for 7, 9, many years. In fact, 3 decades. I'm talking on Zoom there. Included in that, the environmental assessment, how long should that be taking? Do you have timelines to say this thing must be done and then report and action? Because these are all sorts of excuses.
Sir, thank you very much. I'm taking your question very seriously, but
the reason I keep on doing this, I'm looking for the PDG projects from Public Works, because that's the person who must assess, but I will try to use my historical and experience knowledge to answer some of the questions, because some of them fall outside the purview of the CIDP.
Let me start maybe with the first question of what are the possible solutions to this particular problem, and then we will deal with all the specific questions that have been asked and raised.
in the last two slides of the presentation, we raise the issue of Kiyama. The reason why we raise the issue of Kiyama is that we are saying Kiyama has not been placed at the right level of where it should be operating as an act. Firstly, we're holding the view that it should actually be treated no different than the Public Service Act, which is transversal across all organs of state that are within government. It should be treated in the same fashion like the Public Finance Management Act, which governs how you manage finances across all in the state, and the same way in terms of the Triple PFA. We say this because there's not a single department that does not have infrastructure requirements. And for when we're saying in terms of level of its elevation, because the minute then you start to elevate it, then into what structures and into what processes, we're advocating that in the budgeting processes that puts out the MTEF and the MTEF committee, Kiyama should be there. It should have a seat in the same way that DPSA goes to that process and makes pronouncements or proposes pronouncements about how public service remuneration should be considered across the public sector. Kiyama should be given the space in that particular process to say how should we be managing infrastructure between custodians and users. It's the elevation of it into that budgeting process. Now, I'm going to say this is my view because we've not even discussed it at CIDP yet. If you manage to do that, the trickle-down effect starts to solve a lot of the problems that are raised in the questions that have been raised so far and others. Because then it's sitting at the right level. Firstly, from a competency perspective, we were having a preparatory discussion with the chairperson for this session to say, one, you expect any accounting officer in government to know how to read the financials in terms of GAAP or in terms of CRAP, depending on what type of entity you are. You expect every accounting officer in generally accepted accounting practices. GRAP generally recognize accounting practices. That is what is expected of any for them to be able to read their financial statements, which they are required to submit to Parliament by set dates and procedures. Those are standard expectations. And maybe from a competency level, because the minute you pitch it there, it then starts to say there should not be a single accounting officer that is not conversant with the Government Removal Management Act in terms of policy requirements and then also in terms of standards and procedures which are captured in terms of SIPDM. So I think it's firstly about putting it there. Now, this is a very difficult question that you've asked the committee because we account to the Minister of Public Works. Now, the beauty of this, I'll say I said it to you, I didn't say it to my minister, but the issue is about saying it's the Minister of Public Works who should elevate Kiyama to the appropriate level in the budgeting process. Because it will start to bring transparency, it will start to bring accountability, it will start to force responsiveness in the same way the PFMA does, in the same way the Public Service Act does. So that is what I would offer as a solution, as a first step, without having thought through what will be the other following steps in terms of priorities. Then I'm going to attempt to answer some of the specific questions. I'm going to request my colleagues, where I miss a question, for them to please to step in and to assist me, because I'm not necessarily a subject matter expert. They are. I've got a responsibility of making sure I'm conducting the choir of CIDP to make sure that it sings in tune. It's not out of tune. The missing implementing agent. I think I want to focus on the things that are within the control of the CIDP on this particular one. And the issue of the role of communities in projects and so forth, etc., etc. We have made some headway. Dr. Mulford drove the process of the CPG, It is covered in one of the slides when we're talking around the issues of transformation and some of the standards, where we have made specific interventions of saying, here is the standard that you should be abiding by if you're going to be starting an infrastructure. infrastructure project in a community to make sure there is buy-in. That particular one deals with those type of particular issues. Involvement and also how do you engage the local economy so that there's equal participation. People don't feel left out and they start to own the project. And the aspect of missing implementing agents at the broader level, it is a function of capacity and also which procurement strategies that they are using. Depending on the type of contracting strategy, you will excuse me, I interchange committee members between procurement strategy and contracting strategy. They mean the same thing. So when I say contracting strategy and I say procurement strategy, I'm talking to the same thing. In a situation, I will use an example that used to be used by a minister, which I will not name, that was once in Public Works, to say, when I grew up, I used to see yellow metal, and Public Works used to do everything. I don't understand these current arrangements. That's what he used to say. Now, in a situation of that nature, that is when the implementing agents got all the resources required to plan, to procure, to implement and maintain, and also to dispose of an infrastructure asset. I do want to advance that we hardly ever have those such entities around anymore in South Africa that can do that entire value chain by themselves. And it will effectively mean you've got all the resources in yourself. There's no space for the private sector because you are not putting out tenders. Everybody is in-house. There's hardly any of those, if any, left in South Africa to do that in terms of that. Now, it becomes that extreme, and then there's another extreme where an entity would have no capacity at all in terms of, when I say capacity, I mean competencies of people who are going to be able to do that particular work. Now, the contracting strategies, there's about five. I will try to remember all of them off by heart. There's design by employer. There is develop and construct. There is design and construct. There is construction management. What is the fifth one? I've listed it. There's one that we've missed. There's a fifth one I've missed. It's fine. It is covered in the presentation, so there's five. Now, the importance of these when Ms. George presents that particular section is that it starts to zoom in on the question of competencies and the presence of implementing agents. In that, I'm going to use my own understanding, but it is defined properly, just so that we can walk together. I'm not going to use the strict, fast definitions as they are captured in the standard. If you have a situation of where, because this is what slide 8, that question is asking for, it's effectively saying choose one of those strategies. Which one are you going to use, or which mixture of those are you going to use? If you were to choose the design by employer, it's in the wording itself. It says design by employer. It implies that the organ of state, which is the employer, has the competency to design, meaning they've got design officers, if I can stretch that far, or have the ability to manage design issues. It's now linking to the question that was asked around the issues of design taking for a very long time. We will see in a slide that when we deal with this aspect, we've highlighted in red, because I've got it in my mind, I know it's there. We are saying the state entities have by default, operative word, by default, most of them by default are using design by employee, not by the choice they are asked to make in terms of what the standard is saying. Now, what does that mean in the context of the current capacity and competencies they have? That they don't have either the competencies to do those designs themselves, nor the ability to oversee the outcome of a design process that will come from a private sector entity, which would then be a contributing factor amongst other factors as to why design is dragging out. You will use design by employer if you have that ability. But there is a particular nuance in this entire aspect. And in this aspect, I'm not criticizing Public Works, but I want to use it as an example because it's one organ of state I've got an insight in because I'm seconded from it. Yes, that's what I'm trying to preempt. I'm not saying because I'll be hitting myself in the process. is in that Public Works is probably, out of all government departments, the most organized when it comes to the national department, that is, in terms of disciplines in various professions and so forth. And you can also implement what Giyama is asking for, even though to different degrees. The challenge, however, which is embedded in design by employer, it requires you to have the full set of competencies. If you were to look at the engineering profession as an example, looking at the disciplines that are there, the ones that are currently being registered, there's about 9, and probably about 7 are applicable to the infrastructure environment. That will exclude aeronauticals and maybe another that I've forgotten. But if you start to look into that space, from my knowledge, I know I've been away, DDG projects may correct me, maybe they've improved. Out of the 7 disciplines of engineering, Public Works probably has 3 or 4 at best in terms of the engineering profession. So they have a deficit. So Public Works in this instance would have to say, if I've got civils, which will include structural, if I've got mechanical, if I've got electrical, and I also have, I think you also have geo,
correct.
Yeah. And if you have these, but there's you have a deficit of another balance of others you do not have, maybe for the ones that you have, you can then employ design by employer. But you can't adopt it across the board even for the ones you don't have. Because in the structure of Public Works, the actual structure, there is no space, a business unit, to take care of the balance that is missing. Therefore, they would need a cocktail. But currently, they're doing it by default. Now, that was what will create then the problems you were speaking to, sir. Why, and ma'am, why designs are taking for eternity to be completed? Because they do not have the ability. So people are improvising from first principles of being an engineer, of understanding how to unpack things, but they're not necessarily qualified for that particular environment to discharge. So that is the first thing. Now, that is linking it now to capacity. Now, for such an employee, if you were to use design by employer, because I want to link it to the question, design by employer, it would then mean when you are in implementation phase, you would actually be missing on site to explain their part. It's not that they don't want to be, they will be missing on site because the only thing they are responsible for is the design and the management of the person who will be doing the work, which will be the contractor in this environment, to do it on their behalf. And they should have a project manager to do it in that regard. This is now, I'm pitting them against each other, the design by employer and a full yellow metal being available for a department. So I'm trying to explain the extremes that you can move through. Then you've got another system, another contracting or procurement strategy. I'm defining them loosely just for understanding, which is called design and build. What will be the contrast of design and build from design by employer? Design and build would acknowledge that the state organ does not have the design capacity nor the ability to manage design outcomes. In private sector, it's generally called turnkey projects. It will then say, for such a situation, you want then to be that be the policy, the procurement strategy to be adopted, so that the department is not burdened, the organ of state is not burdened to do something it does not have the competency nor the capability to do. What it will potentially need are people who can brief and scope what we want the infrastructure to do and put out a request out there for tender for someone to do the design and construction on behalf of the implementing agent. Now, that deals specifically with the issue of skills shortages, but this is why that slide 8 is so critical, and also the issue of presence on them on site, because it's acknowledging, firstly, I don't have the people, I don't have the money, I'm only given project money. Therefore, to that extent, what procurement strategy do you use for you to be able to achieve what is expected of you to achieve? I hope I've explained that, and there can be potential comebacks there, but there will be a presentation later on how they all work. Then, role in determining pricing. The answer to that question, do we have a role in CITP in pricing? We do not have a role in the pricing arrangement. It would have to be between the contracting parties. Now, this is where, again, the procurement strategies become important. If you are using design by employer, it then implies that when that pricing of that document gets done, the department must have somebody who is competent in cost engineering,
who would then be able to contract to cost engineer the key items of any bill that will contribute 80% of the value, and normally the Pareto rule works in here. 20% of items in any bill or in any contract generally generate 80% of the value of the contract. So that is what you would want to price. And you would want your own internal person to do that cost engineering for yourself, for you to be able to know when you are getting price offers that they are actually sensible or not. But in the absence of you having that competence, don't use design by employer rather than rely on design and build. Because you won't have the ability of doing that spec in terms of cost engineering and being able even to evaluate it in that particular regard. So firstly, we are not involved. I'm offering now my advice because I'm a construction manager by qualification. So these are things I know in terms of what happens when you are pricing. But it's like writing an exam. A tender is like an exam. A person knows what they're asking, but they must have a script. Now, what you are finding in most government departments, they don't have that script by which they assess. They just look at the answer and assess the answer without having a script on which they mark on to say, if you get this, then you don't get this mark. That is a fundamental problem that can be solved when what you people make the appropriate choices as requested by the standard. Because then you know exactly where your focal points become. The blame game, what's our role? We do have a role, and to that end, the board and the strategy of the CIDB is reflecting on us having to develop alternative dispute resolution mechanisms so that we can solve issues in a non-litigious manner, which is currently the case within the industry of construction. So it's something we're working on, but we have not developed those. But what is the source of the problem? Not necessarily the problem. What governs this environment that deals with the issue of why do we get into this situation? We mentioned the standards of uniformity. The standards of uniformity deals with three aspects. It deals with saying what forms of contract are allowed in the public service to be used, and there's four. It also deals with the issue of procurement strategies, which we've been discussing, and also the manners, the format of contract. I'm looking at you for backup, but I don't remember everything. Yeah, they're still going to present, I know. But then within the forms of contract, the four that is endorsed, we've got the GCC, which stands for the General Conditions of Contract. We've got the JBCC, which stands for the Joint Building Committee Contract. Then we've got the NEC, the New Engineering Contract. We've got FIDIC, NEC, the New Engineering Contract. NEC. No, not that NEC. Yeah. That's an NGO. No. The New Engineering Contract. yeah. And we've got FIDIC. What does FIDIC stand for?
It's an Italian word. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. On that one, we found one thing. We can't remember what that acronym stands for. So we've got these four. All right. Now, these four contracts are the ones that the public sector can use. So it can also inform part of your questions of oversight. Are you, if you're asking a department or an executive, which of the four are you using and why? Because that the why part actually will start to reveal a lot of things. But I'm going to get to it. Now, all of these contracts, they are actually the basis through which the contracting parties actually contract in the public service. Now, all of them are designed for particular purposes. They are not intended to be used across the board. They are used for particular circumstances. And just for explanation, I just want to focus on two, the ones that are prevalent in the public sector, not in terms of departments, but not in terms of state-owned entities. State-owned entities have a preference for the NEC. By and large, am I correct, Rodney?
And
FIDIC. The SOEs have a preference for and FIDIC. But for government departments, they have a gravitation towards the JBCC and GCC. But I want to use the JBCC and GCC as a point of departure at project level, because that's where the contract happens. Now, these two forms of contract
And I'm not trying to purport to be a contract lawyer, nor a construction lawyer. Everything I'm going to say now is what I learned in school when I was doing contract law. They are designed for separate purposes. The JBCC, when you contract, in terms of contract law, you are contracting on the basis of your offer you are making, the total lump sum at the end. That's what makes the basis of your contract. And it also is a contract that says you are dealing with things that are known, like a building. You know how many bricks, that's why you've got quantity surveyors will go in here by estimation, how much mortar. You are dealing with known outcomes. That's what the JBCC is for. Then you get the GCC. A GCC, when you're contracting from a contracting perspective, you are not contracting on the lump sum offer. You are contracting on a rate per item basis. So whatever is in the schedule of the bills of quantities or schedule of items in that contract, you are contracting on each of those particular items, not the final sum. It also has a contribution to the issues of overrunning project prices, because if you use the GCC, you can't rely on that, what has been put at the end as a collection addition of all the item values, because you're not contracting on that basis, you're contracting on a rate per item. But the trick comes in asking this question: what is the GCC intended for? The GCC is intended for contracts where the outcomes are not potentially all known, for uncertain circumstances. What are those potential circumstances? It was designed to deal for civil works for all intents and purposes, where you're going underground. You may meet a different strata of soil, a different strata of rock, and different permutations, because you need to sample, you do not know what you may encounter. So the way it's even designed, you get all the potential items you may encounter in that project and you must price it. But you may not encounter 50% of them because you are dealing with an unknown outcomes contract. Now, the first problem arises that firstly, you pick the wrong contract for the wrong works. So if you take the GCC and you use it to build schools, it's a wrong contract already. It's already setting you up for the blame game, as a way of explaining. And its outcomes can also be disastrous for a particular project. And so the saying goes. And again, if you say, if you want to do to lay a pipe in your water affairs, and you go and use a JBCC, it will be nonsensical, because you have no idea of how many rocks you're going to meet up of different strata, and you can't quantify it up front. So that's what firstly creates the problem of using the wrong forms of contract in a particular types of works, and then can permeate and can just blow out of control and can raise a number of issues. I do not want to dwell into the issue of how that impacts the PPPFA, because that's another subject matter for another presentation on its own, and we have not even fully interrogated in terms of what that means. Now, the question of what's the role of IDZs? Public Works, you're here. I'm going to offer my understanding on this one. I'm not going to claim to know. But what I do know, I want to firstly explain the circumstances as to how some of the IDZs got to be becoming implementing agents. If you look at KUGA, which is an agency that I know of the IDZ, KUGA was tasked to establish the IDZ in Nqunga Bay, and in doing so, they then had to build the capacity themselves. All the capacities we've spoken about that are talked about here, the issues of using IDMS and so forth, that capacity and competence is to be able to develop the IDZ. So they had to have their own capacity. So if you look at KUGA, you're looking at an IDZ that's got the ability to deliver its own infrastructure. They build their own roads, their own quays, the bay there, in terms of dugging it out. What we find in Durban, they had to start it from scratch in the port of KUGA. So they built that capacity. So the KUGA IDZ then had that capability, because they could do it themselves. My understanding of what happened in Public Works, during the implementation of the turnaround, the Minister of Public Works at the time then said, I can see we don't have the capacity to do certain things. How do we alleviate the pressure? Who are the people who we know are doing a better job than us? And KUGA became one of them. And KUGA then was brought on board to assist Public Works to alleviate
the pressures of it being an implementing agent not being able to deliver. So that's how the KUHA IDZ became an implementing agent for the Department of Public Works. That's the one I can explain. I do not know the extent of other IDZ, but it stems from their capability in terms of being able to do things. I think they are using PRINCE2 as a project management system, which is a very advanced project management system in terms of delivering infrastructure. I think they're one of the few agencies we have in the country that can actually use it and implement it. Right. Question 5, 6. The question of when was SIPDM brought into effect? July 2016?
Introduced in 2015, and the application of the standard was actually from the 1st of July 2016, where it should be have been audited. So there were three areas that the AG was tasked to audit for the national and provincial departments, and those three areas are basically your control frameworks, your responsibility assignments, and also the actual policy, infrastructure policy that was set up. Yeah.
And what is going to do?
Can you attempt to deal with the question on the breakdown of which committees?
The committees basically have been identified through the process of the PFMA and the FFMA environment. So the PFMA prescribed to the accounting authority, who delegated that authority to the CFO of the department to establish committees within the supply chain environment. And now those committees basically are the bid spec committee and your bid evaluation committee and your bid adjudication committee, where the bid spec, they will basically look at compiling a specification that will go out on tender, and the evaluation committee is tasked to basically look at how that spec has been produced and also evaluate on the specification of that project, and then the adjudication committee then recommends for the appointment or the award of that tender process.
Can you just also
Honorable Chair, did you get what he was saying? Was there something I want to add on top of what he was saying? Okay, can you please repeat yourself, because it's very important. Yeah.
We're talking about the committees that were set up. What I've said is that they were established through the PFMA.
And I'm responding to the committees.
The committees. Yes, the established committees. Those committees are basically established through the PFMA and the MFMA.
Evaluation
committee, the specification committee, and the adjudication committee. And where we said that there are different skills within those committees is that we have now analyzed or realized that public sector in general have got a skills gap or capacity constraint in actually coming out with a specification on projects. And that's if you specify wrong items on a project, therefore the evaluation will follow that and they will evaluate, and it will subsequently, the award will be made to a wrong person or wrong contractor. So those are the skills gap that we're talking about in terms of when we say we need to strengthen that area.
This is the part I just wanted then to intervene, is to say there's a question here as a benefit of hindsight. When I was preparing for this, we didn't put out that it needs to be asked. When the executive authority adopts a policy as required, did they then subsequently also amend the delegations of authority to be consistent with the procurement strategy or contracting strategy they've chosen? Because what is just outlined is what would fit into a process of design by employer, which is what the state is using by default. Because the state is doing its own bid specifying things on itself,
It is doing the adjudication itself. It is doing the evaluation itself. Now, it goes back also, sir, to the question you ask around pricing. That is where you need that cost engineering script in the bid specification space. Because if it is not there and you don't have the people to do cost engineering, what are you actually bid specifying for? And what are you going to evaluate? And now this is the question that is fundamental. Have the delegations of authority been realigned to be consistent with the chosen procurement or contracting strategy as listed in the standard? Because it's got those particular implications. Because certain committees start to become irrelevant in particular procurement strategies. Then question 8. The question was, in terms of asset management, does DPW have capacity in this particular regard? Well, I think I've already preempted this one. DPW is probably the most advanced of all government departments in terms of having the requisite in terms of aligning to Kiyama. Because Kiyama speaks of 5 areas of what you need to do. It speaks around planning, which deals with feasibility studies. It speaks to procurement, the acquisition of assets, which is where now you're in the process of acquiring. It speaks to the issue of actually building an asset or in terms of erecting it. It also speaks to the issue of operating an asset, and it also speaks to the issue of decommissioning an asset when it's no longer required. Now, DPW have, at least to my knowledge to date, have established the PMTE, which is called the Property Management Trading Entity, which is then tasked, and the way it's organized in the fashion of all of these stages. The question of whether or not they've been able to map out all the required competencies for all of those stages in terms of their business units, I do not know. Maybe I can leave it to the DDG to expand on that particular one. So, but from my experience, they have the structure, but they do not have necessarily all the people sitting in the right places yet. They don't have the full complement of people to sit in the right places. They do have some, but may not be a complete set. I'm not passing judgment on public works, but this is from a distance, because I used to be there, but seconded to CIDP. I left the process when the department had just approved the structure. We say, here is the structure, but in terms of resourcing it, I do not know where the process is now. I don't know if maybe public works wants to enter into this particular point. Yes, it was one. At least I can account on that. I was there.
Chair, if I'm required to respond immediately, in fact, what has happened is the structure has been approved by DPSA. It's being implemented currently. We have advertised more than 1,000, you know, I have the stats here, I can look for them quickly. More than 1,000 positions, and I filled in excess of 600 of them. And there's 200 of them that are in the process. So this is where the issue that the CEO is raising comes in, where we have staff but don't have the full complement yet. That's why you see the DDG that we've just taken on board now is correctly qualified as well in the field. He's responsible for projects in the department. There are a few others that are on board now for, you know, facility management. We also have a few, you could remind me, just I'm thinking of the cuff now, of some of the skills we have. So it's not complete yet. We're still filling some of the positions. Thank you, Chair.
Then to continue and expand in responding to this. Oh.
Thank you, Chair. Just to expand on my colleague, in terms of the composition of the PMTE, we do have all the necessary divisional heads that are put in place to deal with planning, to deal with actual construction management, to deal with asset management, and I think as far as the resources are concerned, it's a process in which some vacancies are being filled, but there is progress. A lot of progress has been made, and I think we need to acknowledge that. Thank you.
And then, Chairperson, in terms of DPSA requirements, every department must have a service improvement. Service improvement delivery plan.
Service delivery.
Oh, it's the other way around. Service delivery improvement plan, SDIP. Every department is required to do so. I think a lot of the answers to the questions you're asking of having capacity will be found in the answer and the indicators and the plan DPW has submitted to the Department of Public Service and Administration, where it starts to speak to some of these issues.
Chairperson, can I make a commitment that we will provide the chair and the committee with a report? There's a report that we're giving on a regular basis to both the DG and the minister on progress that we're making in making the necessary appointments. We will definitely make that available to the committee, just so the committee can also see and appreciate progress that we made, advice that are going out, and for what exactly the targets are. We're putting a lot of pressure in ensuring that appointments are made. I must be very frank, we've made a lot of progress. But we're sure that by giving the chairperson progress, we should break down what has been done over a period of time. Thank you, Chair.
I'm going to become persona non grata after this briefing because I'm empowering you in a number of issues. One of the things I will say that would make me persona non grata is that I think the committee would need to engage the Council for the Built Environment so that it can give you the identification of work outcomes. Identification of work outcomes speak to the required competencies that the currently regulated built environment professionals we have in terms of what they can do in a so far planning, acquisition, constructing, maintaining, and disposal. Basically what it does, it starts to map out to say which professionals do you need in what space when it comes to built environments. So it will empower the community to have that so that when you are engaging, as an example, an articulate department, let's say Department X for Infrastructure, you say in your, let's say, in your construction space, can you give us the sense of which professionals you have and in which disciplines? The only way for you to be able to check that the answer they give you gives you the assurance that they've got the right people is for you to have that schedule of identification of work that will show you which professions, in which levels, and in which registration categories should be in that particular environment for the work to happen properly. So it's a way of advice to empower the community. The Council for the Built Environment is our sister entity. It also report to the Minister of Public Works. But for me, in respect of this question, for you to be able to ask a question and be informed, you would need to have, if I can use quote-unquote my own words, a script of what should be in every functional area of Kiyama in terms of a skill set. It's it's already there, already developed. Yes, it has not been approved yet because they're still dealing with issues with the Competition Commission, but at least what it does, it maps out what professions you need in a particular functional area of planning as an example, etc., etc. And CIDB has also, Rodney, can you please just assist the committee by explaining the process where we are with DPSA in terms of getting the competency standards for who should be running procurement for construction? Because it's again linked to the question, does the state have the capacity to manage this? So we are empowered through one of our provisions in our Act, and we've already done work, but I want Dr. Mofo just to expand on where are we in respect of the competency standards for supply chain people, the people in supply chain managing construction tenders. Thanks.
Thanks. Very briefly, the CIDB has developed, firstly, a competency framework. And that competency framework unpacks the competencies required for people to operate and enable and in line with SRPDM. There are two groups of people. There are supply chain managers who are typically your administrative mechanisms, and then there are procurement and delivery managers. And we have mapped out, with the help of other organizations, we've mapped out the competencies required for procurement and delivery managers and also for supply chain managers, and we'll make reference to this just now. But we need to, we are in the process of taking it forward now, is whilst we have identified the competencies, and you can use that for in job advertisements or whatever, how does one assess whether the existing people meet those competencies? Now, those competencies typically should be defined in terms of unit standards and the rest of it, but we are busy appointing providers to work with us to develop tools to be able to identify whether SEM officials and procurement and delivery management officials actually meet those standards. Now, we have made reference earlier on to the Council for the Built Environment. They would provide, through the Council, professional registration and recognition, whether it be for engineers, for architects, or whatever the case may be. But for procurement and delivery management, yes, you may be a registered professional engineer, but you still don't have those, may not have those competencies and that experience. So that is where we are at the moment, and we'll make reference to that because we are looking at setting up a system where we can assess among client departments. But if I can just raise one issue here, and I think it's important, and there has been a focus on public works as a deliverer of infrastructure, but we must also recognize that some of the major deliveries of infrastructure are SANRAL, Eskom, water and the like, and their abilities may differ, may be better, may be not. I don't want to pass comment on them, but each institution has to be assessed as they are, and then certainly as we get to the more municipal authorities, they also deliver infrastructure, and that's probably where some of the biggest competency gaps exist. Okay.
Then there was a question of saying, how come do you not have monitoring and evaluation? In the context of SIPDM, SIPDM is the product of National Treasury. So we're not monitoring SIPDM because it's the product of National Treasury. However, in areas that we are responsible for, we are monitoring. And I think, Dr. Mulford, you will deal with some of those areas of monitoring when we are sharing with you around the issues of why is the project under expenditure and so forth and some of the issues. We are monitoring, we do have monitoring and evaluation. And to that end, we're even requested by our Act to the project schemes, to put together project schemes that seek to improve performance, obviously informed by the outcomes of our monitoring, where we are tracking where there's underperformance and saying what are the things that need to be done, these interventions to change the situation of what we're seeing. Yes, Ron.
If I could just raise a point now, and it is subsequent in the presentation, but I think it's important from a monitoring perspective. Every government project above 200,000 Rand, the tender notice has to be, at the moment, in terms of regulation, the tender notice has to be recorded with the CIDB. The project award has to be recorded with the CIDB, and very shortly, contract closure will have to be recorded with the CIDB. Every private sector tender and SOE above 10 million rand must be recorded with the CIDB. And that is a very powerful instrument to monitor price overruns, price delays, site disputes and the rest of it, if we had adequate compliance. And we will talk to it. Compliance by government departments is not acceptable, and we are limited in our ability to monitor some of those issues, and there is a document which has been circulated in this regard. We'll come to that later.
Thanks, Rodney. And then the following question was, we should have a list of custodian departments. If I then piggyback on the response of Rodney, we have the list of departments that are implementing if they report against the register of projects, which we have. But I'm certain we can attempt to pull out a list of who are the custodians in the country, but it's a function of how the constitution has delegated particular functions as being national, provincial, or local. So, and we can attempt to do that if that is a request, but it would mean we need to look at the constitution and look at all the known infrastructure departments in the country and try to assign them whether they are considered custodians or they're considered users. In terms of doing that, I have to look at my legal person, Ms. George. First, how much time do you think you would need to be able to try to attempt to compile a list of who is a custodian and who is a user in the country?
We can do that through the register.
Time? Can I suggest 10 working days? It's 2 weeks. List of custodian departments to do. I just want quality control. No, thanks for that, Chair. We will do that. I think the follow-up question was building up on that, because it was asking how then do we assess impact. And I think the point of emphasis here, when it comes to the SIPDM, it will be National Treasury. Our own assessment is what we're also going to report on today in terms of what Dr. Mulford has already alluded to, in terms of the projects that have been reported in the Register of Projects. Because it is their area within this environment. They own the SIPDM. We have not incorporated. I don't know. Rodney, are you aware that Treasury is tracking monitoring compliance of SIPDM?
Treasury, to my knowledge, is not tracking tracking on the ground. Richard, did I ever refer to that it is a requirement for the Auditor General to audit, have they set up a policy, is that in place and the like? It is also a requirement, and I will refer to it later, that within 1 month of the end of the financial year of every institution, they have to submit to National Treasury the total spend versus budget, the total number of average days of payment and the like, and I'll talk a bit to that, or we will talk a bit about that later. I have no confirmation that that information is being sent to National Treasury yet. But I can't say it is not being sent. We are trying to access that information from National Treasury.
Honourable members, that's our other angle when we meet National Treasury.
Then there was a question around feasibility studies. Are they being done or not being done? Now, we need to just step back again. If you recall, we mentioned that they work in a triangle. There's the SIPDM, that is the standard, and then there's IDMS. I firstly want to start with IDMS, because IDMS actually has broken down the process into three major levels: portfolio management, project management, and operations. Portfolio management, if you are implementing IDMS, you should then be doing the feasibility study. The standard then took from IDMS the required work before you can proceed to whether or not you do a project, when you make the go or don't go decision, that you have to go through the gate. Which gate is it, Richard, before? So it's a requirement. So this standard does specify that to say you can't make a decision on whether or not you are going to proceed or not proceed without doing a feasibility. I just want Richard in terms of to show us which gate is it, because they've got a gate system of saying these are the gates that you must go through in each project. And maybe the question then becomes, when a project, you are assessing a project or a portfolio, is to ask the question to the people accounting or who you are doing oversight on, are you observing the gates? Of a particular project, you may want to have a portfolio of evidence of saying, show us a portfolio of evidence that you've actually gone through the gate appropriately. Because that's the only thing that will demonstrate whether or not people are complying with the requirements of the standard or not. Because it's one thing to have a policy on it, but it's another thing whether or not you're actually following what the standard is actually saying you should do in your processes of approval. This is why also I made the point earlier of saying, once you've adopted a policy, have you then dealt with the issue of aligning your delegations of authority? Because these gates change the arrangements that are currently in place of who approves what, at what level, and when. But Richard, let me hand it over to you just to cover at what point is feasibility required by the standard.
The feasibility is required. If you look at the standard gates, they are gate 0, gate 1, and 2. Basically looking at your project initiation, your infrastructure planning, and your strategic resourcing. Basically, these are within the environment of the portfolio management process. Now, once that process has been approved, therefore it kicks in another process, which is a project management planning process, where now a pre-feasibility study and a preparation of a briefing report is actually have to be established. Once that is established, therefore, it kicks in another feasibility study where there's a concept where the project says it's a yay or it's a no. Because once that you have established whether there is budget for the project, there is a need for that project to go on, and then therefore you can go on to a detailed design process, which is now your gate 4 and 5, where you look at your concept viability report. If that project is viable and the viability report says, yes, you can go on with this project, then your design development report is accepted at that process, and then your documentation and production information kicks in, where now you can start your development of your procurement processes, which is that area there. So all these areas here are actually having gates that are there. But what is also on the standard is that the standard has introduced now different levels. And in those different levels, the standard says, it prescribes actually, it says if a project is more than a certain threshold or a certain value, like 1.5 billion, there should be at this gate, there should be an independent assessment or review of that process, meaning that there must be an independent process where an independent team comes in into that department and actually establish whether that department has undergone through this process for them to actually engage in that project. So, and also as their thresholds increase, it also introduces a gateway review on this process, on your design and development or documentation process, and then therefore it does that in that process. And those gates are basically also linked to the there are different templates that are governing this to make sure that the process can be auditable. So they are actually linked to your procurement gates to say that once now you have done the approvals of these processes here, then you are able to then, say, link all those processes with your procurement gates to say that now the process can be easily be auditable in terms of that process. So that there are templates that are already embedded in the standard that are already covered in this.
Chair, I think I've dealt with it.
Just to add to what has been said, the gate system is probably one of the best ways of getting control over your projects, because at each gate you assess your business case. So in the beginning, you start off with a project that you have conceptualized, and then as it develops, you evaluate your costing, you evaluate your time. For implementation and for your design, so it's a process where you're always checking against your baseline and see whether the project is indeed viable. By doing this, you do a lot of front-end loading in your planning. So by the time your project gets into construction, you're able to manage the risks that are associated with a project. So you're more familiar with your environment. You've done proper geotechnical work up front, you've done the necessary engineering work, you're aware of your social conditions, you've managed your stakeholders. So by the time you start to implement your project, it's destined to be a success. Thank you.
Summary, Chair, the reason why the SIPDA was introduced, basically it was introduced to make sure that there is a responsibility attached or signing off any processes within the accountability process to make sure that people are accountable for the decisions that they are taking in delivering the infrastructure. Basically, that's where you see the gateway system, your procurement gate and all that, so that all the responsible parties within a delivery chain of infrastructure are actually accountable in terms of what comes out of that delivery process. With that, I will hand over to Ms. George.
There's a preface to this, ma'am. Now, this is where we're dealing with the question you posed to us in terms of how to effective oversight for infrastructure projects. In essence, how do you want to hold the executive to account? Ms. George?
Thank you, Chair. Honorable members, I will be dealing with this particular aspect, and the content of my presentation will touch on issues related to capacity and competency related to programs and projects, the contracting strategies, the forms of contracts, the contract management, and some indicators and the oversight responsibilities that we want to leave to members to ponder on. Chair, I think it is important first to say that, pose a question, what are the challenges facing delivery currently? I think the CEO has alluded to some of the challenges that are facing the industry in terms of delivery. I think one, and the critical one that we are facing with, is related to capacity. There are capacity constraints that exist due to the continued use of outdated delivery approaches. And when you link that to capacity, you need to match the capabilities and the capacity that the client has in terms of making sure that they deliver on the infrastructure. On that end, Chairperson, this is the CIDP's intervention, where they've come up with the framework, competency framework, which has already been alluded to. That is being a process of being developed, and that framework is going to align the skills and the competences that the client department has in relation to on how they are supposed to implement the SIPDM and the tools that are going to be used to be able to assess that particular competencies. When you look at competencies that is required from the government departments or clients that are supposed to implement the infrastructure,
there's a whole list of issues that they need to look at. They must be able to develop infrastructure plans. They must be able to develop infrastructure programs and management plans. They must be able to prepare procurement documentation, the technical guidance at clarification meetings, tender evaluations. They must be able to evaluate the tenders after having appropriately done the scoping of the work. They must be able to manage the contract administration. I think that has been alluded to in terms of the forms of contract that actually govern this particular space related to construction. And then be able to manage the risk and also identify the risk and the constraint that they have in terms of delivering the infrastructure. Gateway reviews also, they need to make sure that they are able to, at a particular gate, take stock and see whether they are doing what is supposed to have been done in terms of making sure they deliver that infrastructure. That's related to the client department entities that are involved in infrastructure. And secondly, the capacity that is required from SCM practitioners, Chair. Those also, their shopping list of the things that they need to have competency on. Develop a suitable infrastructure procurement and delivery management SCM policy. I think, Chair, it cannot be overemphasized the issue that was alluded to, that policy that they need to have in place to make sure that they are able to take into account all the areas that are required to take decision on that implemented into their policies. The institutional infrastructure procurement tender committees that we have also touched on, the committees that are required for be able to evaluate all the tenders that have been called for, the specification, the evaluation, and the bid adjudication committees. Linking the infrastructure to the broad government, broader planning project, establish what is it that needs to be procured, preparation of procurement documentation, advertisement of tenders, and tender box arrangement. You know, this issue becomes critical when the tender closes. It is supposed to be a very critical management, how you make sure that at the time the tender closes, at least there's someone at that point in time to say that it's 11 o'clock, anything that is submitted after whatever time that is set on the tender document is might be excluded, because there are tenderers as well. They actually watch the space. There are people who came late and their tenders were actually accepted by the department. So that's the thing that needs to be managed at that process of a tender box arrangement. The issue that needs to be clarified at that first meeting of clarification meeting, that needs to be the officials that are involved in that process, they need to know exactly how to handle that particular clarification meeting. The receipt and opening of tender proposal and how to look at the issue of responsive and checking the test of responsiveness of the tender, how the tender evaluation needs to be done in terms of the due process that needs to be followed, how the award of tenders need to be looked into, contract management, contract administration, very critical, Chair, and also the reporting on the outcomes of that particular tender process. Those are the skills that we say that the supply chain official need to have, and it's also being detailed in terms of the competencies that we actually have developed that we're going to be rolling out soon after obtaining all the necessary approvals from the government, DPSA, National Treasury, so that we are in line with the competence required. Chair, I think it is important to ask the question again, what is procurement strategy? Acting CEO mentioned that we're using this term interchangeable, but basically procurement strategy is a combination of delivery management strategy, the contracting strategy, and the procurement arrangements. All those particular issues, Chair, they are covered in the SIPDM, because SIPDM is a combination of both the IDMS and also the procurement arrangement and the contracting strategy. And some of those elements from the SIPDM emanate from our standards for uniformity. Now, where does this procurement strategy actually get developed? It developed, Chair, at a single project or at a portfolio of projects. This is the slide that we're now talking about. What happens at a particular level of the, either a project level or at a portfolio of projects. These are, we highlighted that stage one, just move on, Mosby. A stage
stage one, which is phase zero, related to the project initiation. We need to know at that stage what are the deliverables that we are looking for. That definition there, it actually applies to us that you need to have a business case together with the project cost and propose schedule of single project or group of projects having a similar character and characteristics of what needs to be done. That's stage zero, and that needs to be decided at a portfolio or level of the whole cycle of delivery of infrastructure. And the second phase is related to infrastructure planning, and also what are the end results that are expected from that a particular phase, and also we're saying that that should be linked to our to the portfolio of projects. The strategic resourcing also it should be linked to the portfolio project, and then the end result, what is expected from that particular end of that stage of delivery. Same, we talk about pre-feasibilities and feasibility studies. They are all happening at a portfolio level. So where certain decisions need to be made by the client in order to if I put it that, those are the things that needs to be looked into when we're doing the gauge reviews. Where are those actual stages? They meet those and deliverables that are listed there. Chair, I would like to continue and say that when we talk about procurement strategies, I've mentioned, Chair, that a procurement strategy is a combination of three issues. One, which is a delivery management strategy. So when we talk about a delivery management strategy, what should be our main focus? Our main focus, Chair, on that particular issue is that we need to analyze the medium-term expenditure framework plans. We need to perform organizational and market analysis. We need to formulate primary and secondary procurement objectives. We need to make certain strategic management decisions. If the client got this right, to capture all that information when they're looking at their delivery management strategy, you're able to assess that they might be moving to the right direction. The question that was raised or issue related to the implementing agencies, it's something that is very critical because it's supposed to be decided at this particular strategy where you're looking at your making certain strategic management decisions. You're talking about there about your PPPs, public-private partnership. You are talking about your outsourcing. You are talking about whether you're going to do leasing arrangement. You talk about using of the implementing agents. So as a client, this is where you need to make those particular decisions that will inform exactly how you're going to deliver this particular infrastructure. So it's a gathering of information which is very critical. It's how to decide on the procurement issues that needs to be looked into, and how you make the appropriate decision on the proposition that needs to be taken on how you're going to follow the needs of that particular project that needs to be undertaken. I'm not sure whether I'm making sense. Should I continue? Okay. Chair, I think the issue that has been raised related to the challenges, the design that we have kind of mentioned earlier on, I thought it's also important for me to mention that in the absence of this delivery management strategy, the risk that we are running with is that we are going to have design and documents that are incomplete before the tenders are being advertised. And secondly, we end up having a crisis management where now we are trying to cut corners in terms of the planning process. Because all of this delivery management strategy is all about planning. And we're going to end up having fragmentation of design and constructing of the construction of that particular project. And we're going to have one of a major problem, we're going to have significant cost overruns, and we're going to have consultants driving the project. I think it's important to note that If you don't have the client department that doesn't have the delivery management strategies, these are the risks that we are actually facing in making sure that we deliver that particular infrastructure. And the second issue, Chair, when I talk about the combination of what is a procurement strategy, is related to deciding on the contracting strategies. I think we have dealt more on the contracting strategies that we have currently, and the acting CEO have alluded to that there are five, and the most common one being the design by the employer. There are certain instances where that particular project is actually being effective, acting can actually be used. And the contract is that when the contractor will undertake only construction on the basis of full design being issued by the employer. And now that poses a question, does the employer in this instance have the capacity to make sure that they have the design that are going to be issued at the point when they're being needed? As a result, the services of the professionals are being procured for the development of the design, and the contractor is only procured for the execution of the work. Right, this particular model, Chair, of design by the employer is applicable where the client wishes to make a significant technical input into the design process and design details. The client requires flexibility in the development of the design. The risks are balanced between the parties now, because one of the issues that actually arises in the forms of contract is that how do you manage the risk? How are the risks shared between the parties, a client and the contractor? And there's also this issue, Chair, that there's reasonable certainty in cost and time on how to deliver a particular project. And lastly, that the client is accepting that he's going to produce all the information available and that will assist the contractor to be able to deliver that particular project in terms of cost, time, and quality. That is a design by the employer, Chair, and we have already mentioned that this is one of the areas that a government department actually adopt one of their methodology is the one related to the design by the employer. The second methodology, strategies, Chair, is a design and construct. Design and construct, the contractor is required to design the project base where it's supposed to have the preparatory work based on the briefing that is receiving from the client, and that they develop there's already a concept, a report that has already been put in place by the client, and then the contractor then would be able to do finalize the design and do the construction thereof. So this particular strategy, Chair, can only be used where the client has a clearly defined user requirement specification. As a brief, they know exactly what needs to be done, but they cannot take it further in terms of what needs to be done in terms of the design. I'm just giving perspective, Chair, based on this on what is contained in. Yes, design by the employer at the bottom. Design and construct. I'm trying to explain that. Yeah. So I was on design and construct, where it is suitable, Chair, in instances where there's an integrated design and construction and a single point of accountability. And then that is most risk lie with the contractor. Because on the first one, I said that there's a sharing of risk. On this particular one, the risk now lies mostly with the contractor. And this particular strategy, Chair, is used where the project is simple, is moderate to complex projects, and the client has limited capabilities to undertake this project. I think it also touched on the issue that the acting CEO alluded to, that most of the clients, they do design by the employer, but they don't have the capacity. And in some instances, if they can actually acknowledge that they don't have the capacity,
then they can actually consider one other of these options, which is the design and construct. And the develop and construct chair, which is another strategy. On this particular one, chair, the employer has a design development report that is already in place, and the contractor will take into account the drawings that they receive from the client to be able to follow this particular strategy of develop and construct. And it can be used where the government has already have standardized design that can be used for that particular strategy. Okay.
Thanks. I just want to highlight something. There was a question that was asked about design. I waited till we came to this particular aspect. It's a very important strategy. There's an issue around the ineffective use of budgets. If you read develop and construct what it says contract based on a scheme designed, prepared by the client. Now that becomes important. It becomes important in the context of saying, if I were to say, as an example, Department of Correctional Services or SAPS, you can employ this, which will say you get an upfront scheme of designs that are predefined of saying what types of correctional facilities do we want in the country to serve the functional purpose of containing people who are convicted, and also to say what types of functional police stations can design do we have, and then you design it once. That's what the design scheme means. So therefore you will have a batch of designs from which you can pick off the shelf without having to go back and pay for something that should be standardized over and over again. Now firstly, you're not employing this for situations like police, corrections and others, where standardized designs and like schools, we are wasting money because we are redesigning the same thing over and over again. If I am Bezek, who owns a design consultancy, if we'd use myself as an example, I tender to do designs for schools. There's only so much design, functional designs you can produce for South African schools because they have to meet particular functional requirements. But they go back over and over again, asking a person to pay them for one design over and over again. So that's a very key issue, firstly from an effectiveness value for money. But from a timing perspective, it will cut out the entire year. There's no need. The only thing you would have to consider are the topographical issues for that particular site, which would be a much more shorter exercise to make sure the design can actually fit in a particular site, because no site is identical to the previous one. So I wanted to emphasize that also the importance of choosing the right contracting strategy becomes critical for preserving money and directing money where it should be so that it doesn't get wasted, etc., etc.
Thank you, SNCO, Chair and honorable members. The two strategies that are left that we need to look into is the one, management contract, which is applicable if the contractor is appointed to be responsible for the planning and managing all post-contract activities and for the performance of that particular contract. And in this particular strategy, Chair, it is applicable to the client and the user who do not have the capacity as well in terms of managing their project. And it is most suitable for sophisticated projects where the client doesn't even have also the issue of the capacity. It comes in again, and that the risk now is more shared by the client in this particular strategy. And the last one, Chair, is the construction management. In this particular instance, Chair, the contractor is responsible for planning and managing, again, all post contract activities and for the performance of the contract. This have a direct this is desirable where there's a direct contract with specialist trades, contractors and small contractors. It manages the interface between the packages of the project, of the project. And it's also suitable when there's a number of trade contractors that have been appointed. I think this is Chris. Let's start.
just want to apologize, Chair. I know there's five. We've listed four. The one she's making reference to is not being listed. We can provide information on it.
Okay.
Yes. I was intervening on
Sometimes, Chair, you go through the presentation after the event, after it has already been sent out, to pick up some of the information that is also very critical.
Construction management.
And, Chair, we're saying that based on these contracting strategies, you need to choose the right contract that needs to be packaged with your strategy. And we said, Chair, that there are contracts that have been approved or endorsed by the CIDP through SFU, through the Standard for Youth Committee in construction. And one of those contracts, the agency alluded to, is related to JBCC and GCC and all the suits, or we call them the suit of the NEC contracts, which talk to engineering and construction contracts. The other one is the NEC short contract, and then there's also a suite of FIDIC contracts, which normally classified according to the Red Book, Yellow Book, or Gold Book. But specifically, the FIDIC, their contract is one that talks about condition of contract for construction and building and engineering works designed by the employer. The other condition of contract for plant and design, and another contract for EPC and turnkey projects, and the other one talks about four forms of short contract that can be used if the contract is not for a long duration issue. Chair, like I said, Chair, it is important that clients, they must use the right contract that will go with the right strategy, depending on the right work or on the appropriate project that they really want to undertake. The last aspect that deals with the procurement strategy, Chair, which is not on the presentation again, is the procurement arrangement. We have various forms of procurement arrangement. I think that has been taken care of in terms of the SIPDM, where you have to decide on a procurement procedure that need to be followed. That's related to how you do your negotiation procedure, on how you go out for competitive selection procedure, and also the issue of how do you come up with your eligibility criteria that needs to be used in making sure that when you invite the tenders, you are calling for the right people. Chair, this slide, it kind of confirms what has been already been said, that there is a challenge relating to capacity, and that government doesn't even have enough pre-construction management professionals that need that particular function. Now it becomes outsourced through the private sector so that they can actually bring in capacity to government to be able to deliver their infrastructure. Okay. Chair, it is also important to mention that there are some indicators that CITP has worked on that will actually talk to the issue related how they've done their surveys in related to the indicators that are going to be pointed out in this particular presentation. If you look at that slide 29, Chair, it talks about the surveys that have been done that say that 18% of the projects surveyed, clients were neutral or dissatisfied with the performance of the contractor. And then 13% of the projects surveyed, the levels of defects were regarded as inappropriate. And then the survey done by to the contractors were kind of neutral and dissatisfied with the performance of the client, which is sitting at 18%. And then the contractors were neutral and dissatisfied with the quality of the tender document that were issued by the government department, that is sitting at 17%. and 60% of payments of contractors were delayed for longer period than 30 days. You know, Chair, that this is a government policy in terms of the PFMA, that payments should be done within 30 days. But now the survey suggests that 60% of those payments were not done within 30 days. The quality was not taken into account in the adjudication processes. I think this is that 12% of that is part related to those committees that we were talking about earlier on, that there needs to be those separation of responsibility between the specification, evaluation, and adjudication. So some of those particular aspects related to the quality of those tenders were not actually taken into account during adjudication. And then there's 9% of saying that the tender committees, if where they have overruled the award of that particular tenders. I think the next slide, check is a breakdown of this information that we have already spoken about in terms of the percentages. Another survey, Chair, that has been done has also indicated that between 2010 and 2016, over 100 public sector contracts have been terminated because of failure to perform. And some of the contractors, the reason that they have not performed is related to non-payment. This following slide, Chair, it gives you an indication of the underspend on budget at local level, related to the metro, the district, the local municipalities. And also the budget related to the key drivers of infrastructure, the information I think that you also requested on the custodian client. Education, there's key drivers of infrastructure, health, public works, roads, and transport. So all the issues that are related to the survey is an indication of some of the problems that are sitting in client department in terms of how they're supposed to spend their budget. And it's also linked to how they're supposed to adopt their strategies and the forms of contract in order to be able to deliver.
I just want to intervene here a bit. Honorable Chair and honorable members of the committee, you will note that you see all of those numbers are negative, with the exception of quarter one of 2016. Now, in relation to the statement that that your letter, the way it was written, I just want to build a link. The state is the single biggest buyer in the market, so it shapes market behavior. It runs at around 40% as a single buyer. There's no other player in the industry that has that buying power. Now, in having this buying power, we are not spending our budget. That's the first problem. What is not being communicated in this slide, which is communicated in other slides, and I may want Rodney to come in here, is that, just maybe to provide some of the figures, if you have them offhand. The infrastructure budgets have been increasing in terms of nominal budgets. But in terms of real terms, in terms of inflation, accounting for inflation, and construction inflation is actually higher than the CPI, because you have to rely on the PPI, the producer price index. It's much more higher than CPI. When you take that into effect and you apply it, you realize that infrastructure budgets have been declining overall in real terms. Yes, the number looks bigger than the previous year, but it's actually lesser when you start to affect inflation, the impact of inflation. Now, Rodney, you may want to expand in terms of how that impacts in terms of generations of employment, because we are still the only sector in the economy that is still in technical recession. And this is a fund, and what we are displaying in terms of budget is driving that. It's not as if the money firstly is not there. We are not spending it. And even the money that is there, we are saying it's less and less every year, and we are losing jobs, and we are still the only sector in technical recession. I think for me, those were the three key messages I wanted to communicate. But I would want Rodney just to expand on the detail. Thanks, Chair.
If I can just elaborate, excuse me, what that shows at the municipal level for the end of the financial year 2016 quarter two, they underspent by 13 billion rand. That was what was returned to Treasury. That's a lot of lost job opportunities, skills opportunities, transformation opportunities. As the CEO has said, if one looks in real terms, the infrastructure budgets are going down in real terms. We are spending in real terms every year less than what we spent last year. And the forecast, we are looking at a forecast of in next year and the year after that of negative growth in infrastructure of around minus 3%. That is the reason, amongst others, why we have lost 104,000 jobs in the construction sector, because of the negative expenditure and that 13 billion where government is under expended. We could have closed that gap by 13 billion, which could have added on another, I think the number is 3 or 4% onto construction spend. So we've lost a lot of jobs, we've lost a lot of skills opportunities, lack of attractiveness and the like. So the money is there, it's a case, or in many cases the money is there, but we just need to spend it as well. But government is cutting back because of fiscal constraints, international, you know, economic conditions and the like.
To answer your question, Chairperson, everything we've been speaking about around the adoption of a policy around contrasting strategies and complying with IPDF is the solution. Because if you start to unpack what are the driving factors why we're underspending, the organs of state are not implementing the standard and they are not using the appropriate procurement strategies. Because even if the argument is you don't have skills, there is a contrasting strategy to accommodate your lack of skills. So the reason and rationale of saying we don't have skills becomes redundant because you are not exercising your other options.
Thank you, Chairperson. CIDB, one of the projects that is under development is the one that talks about kind of opportunity. I think we have alluded to this here in our... Anyway, never mind.
Sorry. Okay. I think, Chair, what is important about this particular project is that CIDB now will be able to say we're assessing the competency of the client department in terms of their skills, the competency that has been required for the department, and also the competency that is required for the SAM official in order to be able to deliver infrastructure. This information, Chair, is going to be very critical to make sure that we are moving again with the issue of our project assessment scheme information that might also assist us to assess the level of maturity and the level of competency of a particular department in order to deliver infrastructure. I think CEO kind of stole my thunder, my moment, to say that without a government department making sure that they have that policy that talk about their delivery management strategy, talk about their contracting strategy, they talk about their forms of contract that they're going to use, and also the procurement arrangement that they were going to adopt in inviting particular tenders. There's no hope. There's something needs to be done so that we can actually test them against those particular strategies that they need to put in place so that we'll be able to move forward. In terms of the effective oversight that we saying that the committee can actually consider, is the issue of client capacity. Whether the clients do have the capacity to deliver, whether the department that they know decide on which procurement strategies to look to use, and whether their programs indicators that they put in place that will assist them to make sure that they connect the dots in terms of the whole value chain on project management, the portfolio of project and the project itself. And also lastly, Chair, which is the compliance with the CIDB Register of Projects. The CIDB Register of Projects, Chair, it's very critical and very important. It is CIDB is mandated in terms of the Act to make sure that they gather information, the nature, the value, and the distribution of projects. So So if that information it is available, it can actually assist us and take it somewhere in terms of monitoring some of the projects that have already been approved, because we need to get the name of the contractor and a professional that might be involved in that particular project, the value of that particular project, and issue related to the variation that may actually be undertaken in that particular project. It even went further to say that you need to link the dots in terms of the project. Does it relate to a bigger scheme of contract that we have? Does it relate to a program that has already been registered? Or is it related to a public partnership arrangement? So that information it comes key, and it's very important for CIDP to have that particular information to be able to do some sort of monitoring in relation to the projects that are already in place and are in the process of being implemented. And it also gives you the duration of that project. When is it? When was it awarded? When time period? Is it for a year? Was it for 3 years? So that we're able to assess that particular information. The key question, Chair, that needs to be asked as well, that's related to the problem level for client department when they're implementing infrastructure. One, has an assessment been undertaken for the capacity for the procurement and delivery management officials, for the supply chain management practitioners in the department? Does a policy exist on contracting strategy that is dependent on capacity? And whether they've done the preparational work and briefing, whether they've done the concept and viability of the project, and whether the design has already been developed, and whether design documents are already available for use for the by the particular contractor who's going to be invited for the that particular tender to do the construction work. Chair, that red bullet cannot be emphasized. We all been saying the same thing, that the design by the employer is a dominant contracting strategy that has been used by government. But the issue is, do they have the capacity to do that particular work? And Chair, in order to be able to use this particular strategy, I think it is important for client to have sufficient in-house capabilities and capacity, either to undertake the design themselves or to brief the consultant properly and oversee the whole process of the design process that the consultant that's going to be appointed is going to be undertaking. In the absence of that in-house capacity, Chair, it becomes a problem to undertake this particular strategy.
I just want to ask you a comment, because for me, this slide is a very important slide. And just maybe so you can use the questions, I want to focus on the second bullet that says, does a policy exist on contracting strategies that is dependent on capacity? Now, those numbers there running down the line, that 3, 4, 5, and 6A, those are the stages of the standard that represents the case, right? Then the question is, at that stage, this is how, if I were to ask a minister so that I know whether they've applied the right strategy, if the department can only do preparation and briefing in terms of capacity, I would say a very uncapacitated client should be using management contractor strategy. Because that is the appropriate strategy if the only thing you can do is a preparation and a brief of what you want of a project. Beyond that, you don't have design people, you can't assess design, etc., etc. But if you can go a step further and you can do concept and viability, then design and construct strategy is appropriate for you. If you can go further and do design development yourself, then your development and construct is appropriate for you. But if you can do design and documentation, then design by employer is appropriate for you. I'm just trying to show the way it works through those gates. So it's linked to the capacity of an organization. So if I'm faced with a situation, let's say I'm in a municipality and they are grading them now, and somebody says, this municipality has no built environment people in it at all, therefore that municipality should be using management and contractor procurement strategy. Should not be a question, because you don't have people who can go beyond a preparation and a brief document of what we want, which can be explained by needs and wants of a particular community. etc. So just to show how to use it, because I think this light is very effective. It becomes your ability to test whether the minister